You are listening to Devil We Know, a true crime podcast, which may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
In this episode of Devil We Know, the secret life of a pedophile and killer is unveiled for the world when one of his targets escapes and names him as the attacker. What police learned after arresting this man was almost too horrific to believe.
Sarah Ann Wood was 12 years old when she was abducted by Lewis Lynn on August 18, 1993. He pulled the girl into his van while she was walking her bike along a rural road near Frankfort, not far from Utica. Though the convicted serial child killer gave clues as to where he hid Sarah Ann's body near Racket Lake in the Adirondacks, her body has never been found. Now, nearly 20 years later, Herkimer County District Attorney Jeffrey Carpenter may resume the search for Sarah Ann Wood. He spoke with me by phone.
We're looking at this anew. We're going to devote some attention to it, and we're going to try our best to locate her.
The disappearance of Sarah Ann Wood came as quite a shock to people in and around the city of Utica, and they joined forces with police to try to find her. D.A. Carpenter says he will convene a meeting of state police and other agencies to take another look at the file. Captain Mark Lincoln says state police have never given up.
It's been 20 years. We still get some occasional tips that come in. We investigate all of them that have the least bit of credibility.
Despite those tips, D.A. Carpenter still thinks the answers most likely lie with Lewis Lent. Now 62 years old, he's serving a life sentence without parole in Massachusetts for murdering 12-year-old Jimmy Bernardo and the attempted abduction of another girl. D.A. Carpenter says he plans to talk with Lent. Captain Mark Lincoln says the force is ready to help search for the body once again, including some troopers who may have retired over the past two decades.
All you've got to do is look at a picture of Sarah Ann Wood and look at the smile on her face to know that that's the type of case that stays with you your whole career and beyond.
If authorities are successful, they could provide some closure for her family and a community that has one last unanswered question. Where is Sarah Ann's body? Reporting from Utica, I'm Jim Kenyon.
Lewis Lent Jr. was born in a little hamlet called Reynoldsville in upstate New York. The year was 1950, and parents Lewis Sr. and Lois Wood gave him a home and a childhood. That childhood, though, was different from so many others around the area. Not long after birthing Lewis Jr., the two separated, leaving the infant to grow up keeping a close-knit relationship with the mother he knew. Lewis kept his relationship with his mother on the down low, though. Not to be confused for a complete mama's boy, but Lewis had a tough childhood, with or without being called a mama's boy. In fact, there were talks in the family about his father being abusive. Lewis Sr., a hardened man's man, had served in Africa for General George Patton's Third Army in the Second World War. It was in service when Lewis's father even withstood an attack that resulted in him receiving a dangerous helping of shrapnel to his heart. All this to say, it was not unlikely that the rumors about the beatings were true. He had two older sisters as well, and would often get upset when he had to leave his mother's home and spend time with his father. And those talks of abuse had even more to do with rumors that Lewis Sr. had victimized his own two daughters. Lewis Sr. had the two girls in his second marriage, and it was said that he would often lock them in a room rather than actually take care of them. While he would just drink and smoke before finally passing out, a fate that was more than likely a part of Lewis's early life as well. But the trauma of the divorce and the alleged abuse wasn't all the young Lewis experienced. When he was only 6 years old, his 2.5-year-old brother, George Wood, went missing. On July 8, 1956, George had wandered from the family house in New York, and with Lewis being so young, he wasn't able to help the 300-plus firefighters, neighbors, and Girl Scouts searching for his brother. Thankfully, hours later, a neighbor's dog named Penny alerted police to a small and scared little George, trapped in a swamp 1.5 miles from the back door of his home, with only a few scratches. Even though this happened was his sibling, and not to Lewis himself, thinking that his brother may never be seen again struck not only fear in his heart, but in the heart of his mother as well. Panic had truly struck home. While living his early life in New York, Lewis also is said to have asked one Mary to marry him. Though he had yet to even graduate, he was supposedly devastated after she refused. After that heart-wrenching objection, Lewis didn't even stay long enough to find out if graduating was in the cards. In 1967, Lewis's 10th grade year, he dropped out of high school and moved to DeLand, Florida, close to Ocala National Forest in the Lake Mack area, only 30 minutes from Daytona. The city is not famous for much, but there was an old naval air station returned to the city after the end of World War II. An odd and surely off-putting reminder of his father, this town is where Lewis stayed a while picking up odd jobs, like picking oranges and harvesting ferns and the like. At one point, he also studied diesel mechanics, just as his father had. It seemed that Lewis was unable to escape him, so why not make money like him, after all? People who got to know Lewis described him as a loner, while others said that he was just odd. They described a man who was not short of temper, but odd and mellow. Some likened him to a hippie, assuming he probably used psychedelic mushrooms. His world was considered strange and small, but there was one thing that Lewis liked to do, which today would seem unsettling, to say the least. He frequently hung out with teenagers. Nobody at the time ever thought anything of it, because he was like a brother to them more than anything. But for Lewis, his closest friends were three girls, ages 12, 13, and 14. Word was around town that the 14-year-old, Kelly, was Lewis's favorite friend. But this weird kinship with minors wasn't limited to friendship. In fact, in 1970, Lewis had gone out on a limb and asked his 16-year-old cousin if she wanted to marry him. At the time, the two had been working on an engine together beside his dad's house. At the age of 20, he hadn't even kissed a girl before this, but he felt confident after the two became fast friends when he asked her to marry him. She didn't answer because it was quite a shock. Afterward, she told her mother, who just advised her to ignore this strange proposal altogether. And so she did. Lewis wasn't one to hurt for too long, though. A short time after his second proposal, he began seeing Charlene Toby. And they had their first child together the same year. After that, Lewis did what he did best, or at least most often, proposing once more. On February 3, 1972, Lewis married Charlene in Paisley, Florida. They eventually had two daughters, the second one being born later in 1978. In June of 1976, he was arrested in the tiny town of Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, which lies 116 miles from the Mexican border. He was employed there for a short period and picked up some tires from an auto supply store for delivery. However, the tires never arrived to their destination. Later, Lewis paid for the delivery himself, so the embezzlement charges were dropped. Around that same time, a report emerged of an incident with Kelly, the girl who was 14 at the time, and Lewis, in his mid-20s by now, approached Kelly with one of his now signature marriage proposals. She, of course, said no, and their friendship dwindled after that. Whether it was based on the allegations of embezzlement or the problematic situation with Kelly, Charlene had a desire for a divorce. She didn't pursue the litigation completely, though. As soon as she found out she was pregnant with that second daughter of theirs, She stuck around in the same house with a man she no longer loved until finally she was again ready to file. June 11th, 1979, she moved out, this time for good. From the records, it seemed that Lewis never responded in the court file, and the judge ended up granting the divorce on March 9th, 1980. Charlene was granted custody of both daughters, and Lewis was ordered to pay $30 per week child support. It's unknown whether he paid, despite the court order, but it is known where he went next. A few years after the divorce, Lewis moved to Clifton Park, near Albany, New York. Lewis lived in New York once more, and it was all but glitz and glamour. In fact, the man now lived in a shack. He was described by many as unkempt, unshaven, with thick and dirty glasses and long sideburns. He only frequented two places, the shack residence and the local YMCA. Eventually, though, Lewis found himself homeless, and the congregation of a Bible school let him live within its buildings, holding up in a windowless storeroom. It wasn't home, but there were places to sleep out of the rain. When one of the classrooms was split with dividers, he would simply set up a cot on one side. He had no place to shower, though, so of course the smell just permeated the room. Lewis, though, was still considered friendly. He was talkative, too. He would tell newfound friends of a troubled past and of a family member that used to slam his head against the wall and locked him in a room. While living at the Bible school facility, Lewis also became an ordained minister with the Church of Christ. But Lewis kept steering off course, even as a minister. Around 1985, he engineered a real friendship with a single mom of three, a daughter of the pastor, Brenda Muller. She often helped him clean his apartment, and eventually they became acquainted enough to begin making dinner for one another on occasion. On one of these instances, she was over at his place prepping dinner for him, and he just blurted out the question, "Will you marry me?" But Lewis, once again, had struck out. She even told him she wasn't ready to marry him because it was too soon after her divorce. The next day, she told her dad, and the age-old advice was the same. Essentially, the pastor said not to call or go near Lewis ever again. Not long after that, the Bible school closed, and Lewis followed work to the town of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in 1986. In Pittsfield, Lewis continued his string of odd jobs, becoming a janitor at Pittsfield Cinema Center, where he cleaned after hours. However, his ongoing relationship with young children was still something he very much participated in. There are reports that he would often take the kids to movie screenings and give them quarters for games. He seemed like such a nice guy, and nothing triggered the kids to worry about him. One time, he even pitched a tent in the lobby and spent the night there with a boy. But not everyone was charmed by him. The kids may have trusted him, but his boss, not so much. He once said he just wasn't one of those guys you could love. There was nothing about him that was personable. Just one of those guys in a group that nobody would bother with. No matter how he carried on in Pittsfield, Lewis still had his dark past to face. Years after he made his life in Pittsfield, on May 17th of 1992, his father died at the age of 67. Lewis was 42 at the time, and his father's wasn't the only death he faced that year. Lewis had the unluckiest streak of all time, finding the body of a friend in the woods only 2 months later. Not just any friend, though. The man Lewis found was 29-year-old Douglas Maxwell, who was engaged to Sally Wood, Lewis's half-sister. According to the report, Douglas was believed to have been working on a car and was somehow crushed beneath it before he was eventually found. Although the family was crushed, the show, as it were, went on. Lewis's mother, Lois, had a retirement party just a week after the death of Douglas. And 2 months after Lewis Sr.'s death, to add to this, she and her new husband wanted to renew their vows. Because Lewis was close to his mother and now a minister, he was asked to do the ceremony. But there was a lot to be said about the strangeness of this entire exchange. But what was clear was that his dad's death was a very clear trigger of some sort. The man who was once so friendly seemed different now. Somehow Lewis's friends from New York, which wasn't very far away, said that in Massachusetts, Lewis had changed. Once an ordained minister, Lewis had stopped attending church altogether and owned a gun now. He wasn't the same. Once, he threatened a neighbor with a baseball bat over a German shepherd allegedly scaring local children. Another time, he threatened his boss and his boss's family at the theater when he was questioned over the quality of his work. The overall dramatic nature of his actions got plenty of attention, so when his boss got tired of him, he decided to end it. In November of 1993, Lewis had been fired. We will be right back after these short messages. Devil We Know is sponsored by Podcorn, the amazing marketplace designed to help podcasters of all sizes get sponsored the way they want. I've been using Podcorn for a couple weeks now. It's real easy. You just log on, scroll through the many advertisers, send them a message why your podcast would be great to advertise on, and then you're off to the races. Creative control and transparency are the name of the game. Podcorn believes in leaving power in the hands of the creatives, and with their vast marketplace of sponsors with different needs, it's easy for any podcaster to find the deal that works best for them. Start with Podcorn now by following the link in our show notes and find a sponsor today. Just go to podcorn.com to get started. Shortly after this, something happened to Lewis that no one ever expected. That something was a young girl, 12-year-old Rebecca Severis. January 7th, 1994, 7th grader Rebecca left her house at around 7 a.m. to walk to school. She had a backpack over her shoulders and was jamming out full volume to her Discman. She intended to walk down West Street to a railroad underpass, then to cross the opposite side of the street near the Big Y supermarket. From there, she would walk to North Street, where the school was located. This was more or less a rural walk, isolated from people and houses. She had just gotten onto West Street when Lewis came to join her. He walked at her pace, keeping time with the rhythm that Rebecca's feet made as she continually listened to her music. In fact, it may have been so loud that, although Lewis was an inch away from her, he could have gone unnoticed for a while. The music was at full volume, and this was a walk that Rebecca knew. No need to have been worried. She had never been worried before. Eventually, though, she noticed Lewis. She saw that he was trying to talk to her, and when she took off her headphones, she heard one of the worst things a young girl walking alone can ever hear. "Do everything I say, and everything will be okay." Rebecca also saw now that he was pointing a gun at her. Lewis said, "Do you see the gun I have?" Scared and in shock, Rebecca immediately complied. They turned the corner onto North Street, and he switched from her right side to her left, holding onto the sleeve of her jacket. He pointed to a van and said, "Do you see that truck over there?" She affirmed, so he started to pull her towards it. But Rebecca fought. She eventually came up with a better plan, though. She pretended to have an asthma attack and asked Lewis if she could sit down to catch her breath. Maybe it was that nice guy facade he had kept up for so long, but whatever the reason, he let go of her jacket and placed his hand on her purple L.L. Bean backpack, insisting she breathe. With that, Rebecca took the golden opportunity to slip out of the straps of her backpack and run, leaving Lewis standing there. Little known to either of them, Rebecca and Lewis weren't the only ones on the street that cold morning. Luckily, there was a witness. He followed the van and then, with a partial license plate number, stopped at a nearby gas station and found a phone to use. He reported the vehicle and Lewis's actions. Thankfully, the witness also remembered the plates. Lewis's vehicle, a 1983 Ford Econoline van, was located later that day, parked in a driveway in Lanesboro. It had been shoveled over with snow as to give an impression that it hadn't been used since the storm that began earlier that day. When police got to the house, they saw Lewis as well as several other people. When they approached and asked him about the van and the driveway, Lewis told the police that he borrowed the vehicle the previous day from one of the people in the house and had returned it that same morning. He obliged to the police's request for him to come to the station and make a statement. where he was also to be photographed. During this interview, he claimed that his lack of a memory in which he purchased his handgun from Dave's Sporting Goods in Pittsfield was potentially due to an encounter with aliens clouding his memory. In separate reviews, Rebecca and the witness both positively identified Lewis as the man that had tried to kidnap Rebecca that morning. As if the positive identification wasn't enough, Lewis's vehicle had a loaded revolver. Rebecca's backpack and his kill kit, a bag containing duct tape, a knife, a gun, child sunglasses, and candy. Initially, Lewis denied any involvement, but with the persistence of the police, he eventually signed a written statement in which he admitted to everything. When asked why he wanted to kidnap Rebecca, Lewis eventually revealed a cruel and calculated master plan. He was on the lookout for 11 vulnerable victims. He planned to build a small area in his bedroom by separating it with a wall, and this wall was to keep other people away and give him privacy. He also wanted to build shelf-like boxes like bunk beds with a door he could close and secure, where he would keep these girls at all times so that he could take them out when he needed them for sex. He was not yet done with this scheme, though, so to satisfy his sexual desires, he would pick up girls for what he called quickies. Upon the admission of this horrific plan, police conducted a search of Lent's second floor apartment on 18 Hudson Street, where a plywood wall was found and other tools to help with the construction. It all conformed to the plan he said he had concocted, but apparently it wasn't just a plan for him. Lewis said it was on his mind at all times. Lewis confessed that no matter where he went or what he was doing, the foremost thing on his mind was potential victims. If he was going grocery shopping, he was looking for victims. He would make mental notes of their locations as well as notating it on a map. He even had a type. Lewis claimed to prefer slim young girls with long hair between the ages of 12 and 17, who were just beginning to develop. He continually told police that he wasn't interested in overweight girls, nor did he want girls that were too adult. He felt that girls lost their attractiveness to him after age 22, according to New York State Police investigator John F. Murray. Another strange occurrence came from Lewis's capture, though. The discovered pedophile also admitted to murder, a sickening encounter that apparently had happened nearly 4 years ago. 12-year-old James Jimmy Bernardo was last seen on October 22, 1990, in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He had just finished eating dinner and at around 5:25 p.m. decided to go to the mall along Route 20 to ride bicycles with a friend. Except his friend never saw him. According to records of what the weather was like at the time, October had some rain and temperatures in the mid-50s. At the time, Lewis was a janitor at the theater, which was one part of the mall Jimmy headed to that night. At around 5:30, Lewis was just getting off work and was walking to leave when he saw young Jimmy. Lewis states, "At this time, I had an overwhelming desire to have sex with somebody, and he looked vulnerable to me." He claimed to have offered Jimmy $5 to move chairs in the theater. Perhaps Jimmy trusted the man, or maybe he felt bad for him and wanted to help Lewis out. Regardless, he obliged. At that point, Lewis went to his van to get his kill kit, just like the one the police found. When he returned to the theater, he pulled his knife on Jimmy and taped Jimmy's hands behind his back. He took the young boy's bike and put it in his van, and under the threat of death, made Jimmy enter his van, but not before disguising him. After doing so, Lewis drove Jimmy to his apartment in North Adams. It was a drive that was less than an hour, but not for Jimmy. It likely felt much longer. When they arrived, under the cover of scarce moonlight, Lewis coerced Jimmy into undressing down to his underwear and continued to tape his wrists and ankles to his bed. He left young Jimmy tied to his bed and left to dispose of the bike. When Lewis returned, he said that he waited until Jimmy was fully asleep, at which point he took a razor and cut the boy's underwear off. This caused Jimmy to wake up, and he was surely scared, more in this moment than he had ever been. Lewis said about this encounter in his confession that he was looking for a successful sexual partner. If Jimmy was successful as Lewis intended, then he would stay alive. If he wasn't, though, Lewis revealed that he planned to kill the boy. With that silent ultimatum churning in his head, he told Jimmy not to move because he didn't want to cut him. Lewis got himself worked up, but despite trying, he couldn't perform. Instead, he got himself dressed and put a cover over Jimmy. Lewis said during the same confession, "It was at this time I knew he had to die." The next morning, amidst the heavy rain, Lewis took Jimmy to his van, leading him into the woods of Newfield, New York. Blinded, Jimmy followed on threat of death until Lewis put a rope around his neck, tying him to a tree. There, Lewis took one last look at his victim as he strangled him to death. Jimmy was found nearly a month later, as some hunters were trekking a wooded area in the town of Newfield, New York, a good 220 miles west of Pittsfield. It was here that they came across the body of a young boy, clearly dead from strangulation. He was naked, tied to a tree with a rope around his neck. There was duct tape over his mouth and across his eyes, holding a piece of towel in place. Police would later find his clothing as well as tape that they believed was used to bind his wrists and ankles. Because of the confession and the details given that only the killer would know, Lewis was sentenced to life without parole, as well as the attempted kidnapping of Rebecca, which tacked on at least 17 more years. But Lewis wasn't the only criminal in this case. A confidential report given to the governor of New York at the time, George Pataki, revealed a string of police evidence tampering in the case of Jimmy Bernardo. The investigators had apparently created 8 fabricated fingerprints. The detective was supposed to get fingerprint impressions from the corpse of young Jimmy. He took the fingers, used ink on them, and then put the fingers in latent fingerprint lifters, and then dusted the fingerprints before sealing the lifters. It was a practice that intentionally smudged the prints, and yet the detective admitted that there was no legitimate purpose for creating false prints. None of the forensic experts involved with the investigation could figure out why he did it. In the academy, they are taught that the ink impression should be as clear and crisp as possible to ensure that it can be used for comparison purposes. One would never take a clear impression only to screw it up with fingerprint powder. As if that wasn't bad enough, he intentionally took partial prints to obscure their actual origin. As it turned out, though, the investigator wasn't alone in his actions. 2 men were involved, named Leshansky and Hendershot. With Hendershot playing second fiddle to Leshansky in his tampering, because of how much damage was done to the investigation, it wouldn't have been possible for Hendershot not to know about the fabrications. In fact, Leshansky testified that he wasn't only present, but that Hendershot also assisted. Hendershot, however, claimed to remember no details from the autopsy, only that it was his first autopsy and that it was of a child. Law enforcement witnesses in regard to this case refuted. Each one said that they themselves would never forget the autopsy of a child, and that they especially wouldn't forget if it was their first. The fingerprints were fabricated on the day of Jimmy's discovery, but Leshansky himself was arrested almost exactly 1 year later. The fingerprints were not used in connection with Lewis's prosecution, but the duct tape was in the identification unit for months without being logged into evidence or even being turned over to the evidence custodian in the evidence vault. If not for the confession of Lewis Lent, these pieces of evidence alone may have changed the course of the investigation. Even so, ongoing disputes raged over where the trial should take place. Though Jimmy was abducted and raped in Massachusetts, the confession of Lewis placed the murder in New York. With both cases against Lent for Bernardo and Savarese going at the same time, there was another motion to move the trial for Rebecca. In regards to the publicity of the case, because of how many people that were now informed of what Lewis Lent had done, there couldn't possibly be a way for the jury to not have heard or be impartial. Another point of contention, as it usually is, was how the confession was obtained. Lent's lawyer, Richard LeBlanc, argued that it was coerced through unrelenting interrogations. On the flip side, though, independent witnesses stated that Lewis was calm and eager to tell the police what had happened. He allegedly also made a point to correct grammar and spelling in the drafts of his statement. During the trial of Rebecca Savarese, where Lent was facing charges of abduction, assault and battery, assault with a gun, and armed robbery, it's note that high school students, boys and girls alike, used half days at school to drop by the courtroom and observe the proceedings. At one point, over 20 students were a part of the courtroom gallery. Because of his confession, police started to probe more into the life of Lewis Lent, and they started to look up missing person cases in the locations where he had once lived. Lewis at this time decided he wanted to admit to another murder, that of Sarah Ann Wood, a girl who disappeared back in August 18, 1993, in Frankfort, New York. Like Jimmy, she was riding her bike from church to her home, and when she never arrived home, her parents called the police. Her bike was found later that afternoon, several feet from the road, propped up against a tree. In less than a week after her disappearance, the search expanded from local to nationwide. Phone calls poured into the Rescue Sarah Center in New Hartford, and missing posters circulated the country. Her story featured on 48 Hours, as well as America's Most Wanted. Throughout the community, teal ribbons were hung to symbolize the color of Sarah's shorts when she vanished. In 1995, the Sarah Ann Wood Rescue Center in Utica joined the NCMEC, or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It has the special task of preparing and distributing missing child posters. In 2017, this center mailed more than 500,000 posters, resulting in the recovery of 399 kids. So even though she is gone, Sarah's legacy is still saving kids elsewhere in the world. Lewis admitted that he raped and killed her and buried her near Roquette Lake in the Adirondacks. But a few weeks later, he recanted his confession, and the police weren't able to find anything, even in their months and months of searching. In 1996, he again went to his lawyer and said he wanted to plead guilty to killing Sarah. He arrived in court and saw her parents, changing his mind again. Then he pulled the same stunt again, confessing later in an empty courtroom. The district attorney of New York had agreed to Lent's request to spend his life in a federal prison, which he believed was safer than state prison. Prosecutors in Massachusetts, whose murder case took precedence, agreed to this as well. After months of delays, Lewis was sentenced for the murder of Sarah Ann Wood on April 11, 1997. And given an additional 25 years. Sarah's body still has never been located, even with the crude map that Lewis drew out. During the sentencing, Sarah's older brother, Dusty, had a chance to speak, and he said, "You may think you have power over us because you know where Sarah's body is. We know where Sarah's soul is, so therefore, you have no power over us." With the connection that Lewis had to murders and missing child cases that never were thought connected to him, the police have since reopened cases that were once thought to have been suicide, such as Gordon Ierley, age 14, who was found hanging off a tree fort in the woods at the edge of Ocala National Forest in 1981. At the time, he actually lived across the street from Lewis. And on that fateful day, Gordon and a neighbor boy were playing outside in the afternoon, and at 11, the neighbor left, coming back around 2 p.m. to find Gordon hanging by a yellow nylon rope around his neck. His rope had been broken during the fall, though. The friend at first thought it was a joke because one of Gordon's legs had been touching the ground, but it was no joke. Once thought a suicide because of the nature of Gordon's death, this was eventually ruled an accident long before Lewis's trials began, and the investigations were reopened. Even more cases began to pop up, though, like in Bennington, Vermont. An 11-year-old girl and her dad picked out Lewis's picture in a police photo lineup as the unshaven man with thick glasses that tried to grab her at Kmart on December 30, 1993. It was clear that Lewis's capture had brought so many other potential connections out of the woodwork. "It may be 8 cases, it could be 108, said Captain Frank Pace of the New York State Police Bureau of Criminal Investigation. Quote, Some departments may be carrying these preteens as runaways where, in reality, they're abductions, end quote. However, thanks to the act of courage from Rebecca Savarese, the obscurity that surrounded so many children's disappearances and deaths can perhaps finally be cleared. Thanks to her, children in the area were made a little bit safer. Thanks to her, there is at least one less devil in their midst. There is a song written by Greg Lake for his band, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, titled Daddy About Sarah Ann Wood. The link is in the show notes.
Here is the latest on Lewis Lent from CBS 6 in Albany, New York.
Killer confesses to another local murder. Lewis Lent, who is currently serving two life sentences for abducting and killing a 12-year-old Pittsfield boy and a 12-year-old girl from Frankfurt, now has confessed to the 1992 killing of Jamie Lusher. Lusher was 16 years old at the time of his abduction. He was riding his bike at the time from his father's house in Westfield, Massachusetts, to his grandmother's house about 10 miles away when he disappeared. From behind bars, Lewis Lent has now admitted to killing Lusher and dumping his body in the Greenwater Pond. That's in the town of Beckett in Berkshire County. Dive teams will be in the water there first thing tomorrow. Jennifer Lukey joining us now live here in our studio. Jen, you spoke with Lusher's family today. I've got to imagine that they're hoping that recovering Jamie's remains will bring them some closure after so many years.
Well, that's what they're hoping for, Dory, but they are very cautious, as they should be, about believing Lewis Lent. Lent promised the parents of Sarah Ann Wood that he would lead them to her body as well, and all he did was send them on a wild chase around the Adirondacks. Lent is spending his life behind bars regardless, so in this case, the district attorney offered him immunity from prosecution in this case if he could lead them to the boy's remains.
After 21 years and more than 15 interviews with investigators, Lewis Lent confessed to killing 16-year-old Jamie Lusher. The abduction happened while the boy, who was small for his age, was riding his bike to his grandmother's house.
After getting the details of Lewis Lent's confession, the investigation was then reopened from beginning to end. And all those little pieces of information that were gathered over the years now fit in, now made sense.
For Lusher's family, it could be the closure they've so desperately wanted.
I talk about this. I think about this every day.
Jamie's dad says his son left the house that night upset because he wasn't allowed to go on a mountain bike race. It's something that has haunted him ever since.
And because of his mindset that evening, he was a perfect target for Lewis Lent, for a monster like him.
While the family is hopeful, they're extremely cautious about whether the information Lent is providing is in fact truthful. Lewis Lent promised the family of Sarah Ann Wood that he would lead them to her body.
Why don't you tell them where the body is?
But after months of searching, her remains were never recovered.
I watched on television. I was like, he's sending these people on a goose chase. No, digging here, digging there. I mean, I could have found gold faster than they could have found her, and it's sad. It's sad to get a parent's hopes up. Now we got our hopes up, right. Like... You know, they're going to find something, and what if we don't? You know what I mean? And then you're back to where you were before.
There were specific indicators to us that maybe this time it was the time that Mr. Lent really kind of wanted to clear his conscience and give us a broader understanding of what happened.
For the sake of Jamie's family, investigators are hoping that is truly the case.
The situation that Lewis Lent is in now is fine with me. As long as he's in a little cage with no involvement with anybody else, and I said that the only reading material that I would provide for that man is the Holy Bible.
Greg and Dory, dive teams from both Massachusetts and New York State Police will be at the pond tomorrow. Now, this pond is more like a small lake, though. Mm-hmm. There are parts of it that are 58 feet deep, so it's definitely an uphill battle trying to find any remains at this point.
Yeah, I saw what it looks like. It really looks like a lake. And then we're talking 20 years in the water. Are police worried that it may be hard to find something after all that time?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty honest about the challenge moving forward. But, you know, I talked to Jamie's family today, and Jamie's sister actually still has the box that the shoes came in that he was wearing. Mm. And they're rubber soled. They say they're supposed to last 30, 40 years. So they're hoping, if not physical remains, maybe clothing or shoes or something that will put him at that lake
enough
at
proof.
That time. Yeah.
And of course, talking about Lewis Lent here, three child murders that we're talking about that he's confessed to at this point. I've got to imagine police are concerned that maybe he could be connected to more.
Yeah, they won't get into the specifics of it, but today at the press conference, we asked that question, and they said that they are continuing to talk to him. They are continuing to gather evidence in other missing children cases to see if anything lines up. In this case, they're hoping that he's telling the truth in this point, but, you know, I was a reporter in Central New York during the Sarah Ann Wood case, and, you know, I saw the family get their hopes up every time, so I'm really feeling for this family. I'm hoping that, like they said, they're hoping this time he's telling the truth.
I think we all are. After seeing them on video like that, we all are. All right. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you so much for listening to Devil We Know. We love to hear from you new listeners out there, so feel free to say hi on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and leave us your thoughts on iTunes. For every 5-star review I see between now and next time, I'll be sure to give you a shout out. For all of you who like listening to Devil We Know as often as possible, we often early release of our episodes ad-free on Patreon to our loyal subscribers for only $1 a month. Simply visit patreon.com/devilweknowpodcast. You can also go to devilweknowpodcast.com and click the donate button at the top. Any money we accumulate, we always put back into the show. We always appreciate any amount. Thank you so much. This episode, I'd also like to announce that our podcast has also officially reached and passed over 100,000 downloads. It's an exciting time for us here at Devil We Know, and we just wanted to share. This episode was researched and written by Lana Hyatt, with research also provided by Lucy Barton. A special thanks to Chase Gray for editing, and as always, I'm Aaron.
Also, please check out this podcast. I really think you'll enjoy it. Please subscribe and give them a 5-star review as well.
Hello, everyone. Let me tell you about the Apple for the Teacher podcast. I'm Anna Thomas, a teacher and your host. So you're probably thinking it's about reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? Well, think again. It's a fresh take on true crime, where you wouldn't expect to find true crime. In schools. Yes, schools. You will hear tragic stories about murder, abduction, school bus hijack, student disappearance, suicide, kidnap and ransom, a school camp tragedy, the list goes on. So if you're looking for something a little different in the true crime genre, then Apple for the Teacher is for you. So join me as I present the bad apples. But until then, remember to be a good apple.